From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Miss Rhythm, Ruth Brown. She was one of Atlantic Records' first big stars, with a string of top 10 rhythm and blues hits in the 50s, songs such as Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean, Lucky Lips, and Oh, What a Dream. Her 1996 autobiography is being adapted for Showtime, and she has a new CD called R Plus B Equals Ruth Brown. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan has some book suggestions for shoppers still searching for interesting holiday gifts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is visiting troops in Bosnia this holiday week, where he is thanking the servicemen and women for their peacekeeping work.
Bosnia is no longer the powder keg at the heart of Europe because of you. And I cannot thank you enough. Your children and your grandchildren will look back on this moment and know that you have done something not only of surpassing importance, but something that is profoundly good.
The president has visited Sarajevo and Tuzla, where U.S. troops are stationed, but he also spoke to the Bosnian people, encouraging them to work to keep the Dayton Peace Accords, which helped bring an end to the Bosnian Civil War. Jurors have resumed deliberating in the trial of Oklahoma City bombing suspect Terry Nichols. From Denver, NPR's Mark Roberts reports.
The Nichols jurors have so far spent more than 25 hours going over the evidence, more time than the jury that convicted Timothy McVeigh of the crime. Judge Richard Mage gave the panel members the weekend off, saying they should come back refreshed and ready to take up the case. Before recessing on Friday, Mage told the jurors, "You probably would benefit from some time off away from each other." One juror shook his head yes, another laughed and nodded in agreement. The judge also warned the jurors that during the holiday season with family and friends together, people are going to want to ask them about the trial, so he said be very careful. Mage told the jury he had confidence they would avoid any publicity about the case, but he said if they did see or hear anything, to give the judge a note to explain what happened. Today begins the fifth day of deliberations for the Nichols jury. Mark Roberts, NPR News, Denver.
Two former South Korean presidents were released from prison today. They received a special pardon from outgoing President Kim Il-sung. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Seoul.
Former President Chun Doo-hwan had been serving a life sentence for masterminding a 1979 coup and brutally suppressing a civil uprising that followed. His protege and military comrade No Tae-woo followed him to office in the 1980s and was tried as his accomplice. Their amnesty was aimed at heading off pervasive speculation about political revenge. The newly elected longtime dissident, Kim Dae-jung, had been jailed by the two disgraced leaders. There were fears that his ascendancy would aggravate old political grudges. But South Korea is already suffering from a crumbling economy, and Kim Dae-jung sought the pardons to achieve national unity in stopping the economic slide. Human rights activists deplored the amnesty, while others called it part of a needed national reconciliation. This is Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Seoul.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 19.5 points at 7,775. The NASDAQ Composite Index is up more than 6 points at 1530. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher for the first time in three sessions. Bloomberg's Doug Krusner reports.
The market is benefiting from strong demand by overseas investors for U.S. financial assets. Overnight, the Asian equity markets declined when Moody's Investor Service cut its ratings on the debt of South Korea, Indonesia, and Thailand to junk status, which is below investment grade. These developments particularly improve the attractiveness of U.S. Treasury securities, which are often used as a safe haven. The strength in T-bonds has allowed long-term interest rates to fall, which in turn is supporting stocks. There is strength among certain high technology issues, but that's being met with weakness in retailing shares. I'm Doug Krisner.
A published report says Prudential Insurance deliberately cheated customers for nearly a decade. The New York Times reports the Florida Attorney General has compiled a report showing the insurance firm, quote, trained its agents to mislead, misrepresent, and defraud policyholders. The elderly were special targets. Prudential has maintained that only Maverick agents were the bad actors. A Prudential spokesman says the Florida report is unfounded. Last year, Prudential agreed to pay restitution to Florida policyholders. Some analysts say the payout could be as much as $2 billion. A private business research group says executives in the securities industry were the most highly paid bosses last year. The Conference Board reports the average salary and bonus for CEOs at financial services firms was nearly $2 million in 1996. That is double the average pay of insurance industry executives who came in second place. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Smithsonian Folkways, producer of the multi-CD song collection Anthology of American Folk Music. 800-410-9815.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown was one of Atlantic Records' first hitmakers. In the 50s, she was their most prolific and best-selling performer. She recorded over 80 songs for the label between 1949 and 1962. She later sued the label for royalties. Her best-known records include Teardrops from My Eyes, 5, 10, 15 Hours, Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean, and Lucky Lips. Ruth Brown made a comeback in the 80s when she starred in the Broadway revue Black and Blue, for which she won a Tony Award. She also co-starred in John Waters' film Hairspray as Motormouth Mabel. In 1993, the year she turned 65, she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Last year, her autobiography was published. Her latest CD is called R Plus B Equals Ruth Brown. Let's open with a song from it that she's been singing through her career, I Sold My Heart to the Junk Man.
I gave my heart to you, the one that I trusted. You brought it back to me, all broken and busted. I've sold my heart to the junk man, and I'll never fall in love again.
That's Ruth Brown from her new CD, R&B Equals Ruth Brown. Ruth Brown, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry.
This song that we just heard is a song you've been singing through your career. Do you remember how you first started singing it?
Of course I know. I remember this song especially well because it's one of the tunes I used to hear in the morning before I went to school. On a radio station in my hometown, the disc jockey's name was Jack Holmes, and I heard this song and used to hum it with no knowledge of who the female singer was of it at that time. And as time went on, I later found out, and she turned out to be my good friend, that it was Dinah Washington that I was listening to. But this is one of the songs that I heard and started singing around in the USO shows around the state of Virginia, pre-war years, you know?
Now, you sing some very good songs on the new CD. Do you get to choose your songs now, or?
Well, fortunately, now I do have that privilege, even though the thing that was exciting about this album was that the young man who produced it, Scott Billington, he brought a list of songs to me, and it was though he was just tuned into me because just about everything that was on the list, I totally agreed that it was something that I would like to do. So we had a mutual consent about the music. Now, in my earlier recording days, that was not truly the case, of course. Most times they would probably bring 5 or 6 demo records. At that time, the writers had written and then got someone to sing it the way they wanted it to be done, and they'd send 7 or 8 tunes and tell you, well, you've got 2 or 3 days, listen to this, and these are the tunes we're going to record. So there was not mutual consent, and I didn't have that much of a leeway. Indeed, I would not admit that I would have always been correct or made the best judgment, because some of the tunes that I did not want to record turned out to be some of the luckiest ones for me.
Like what?
Mama Treat Your Daughter Mean. I hated it. When they brought it, I said, I'm just not going to do this silly song. And, of course, I didn't record that until 1953, and I had been with Atlantic since 1948. And of all the things that I ever recorded, this is the one tune that people remember. I don't care what I do and where I go, they eventually ask for Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean. And I think probably I'm glad that Ahmet Erdogan sort of insisted that time that we do this song. He heard and felt something in it. And sure enough, it had had longevity like nothing else that I've ever done, you know? So I'm thrilled.
Why don't we play it? And this is Ruth Brown's 1953 recording of Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean.
Okay.
That's Ruth Brown recorded in 1953. She has a new CD, and that's called R plus B equals Ruth Brown. You started singing in church.
Mm-hmm.
What was the church and what was the music?
Well, I started singing in church not necessarily because that was of my choosing, but that was the rule. You know, my dad, and coming from a Southern family, I don't know. I wouldn't say that because it was a Southern family, that was the norm. But I think that practically any R&B artist, the most of us of my ethnic persuasion, started singing in the church. If indeed at all you did have any kind of a talent, the understanding was it was something that was God-given and you had to give that back. And so my father insisted that if I didn't sing in the church, I was not going to sing at all, you know. And then there were those church-going persons who, for whatever the reason, said that what we were trying to do outside the church was the devil's music, you know.
Which you liked a lot,
right? So the devil
got
credit for a lot of good stuff, I tell you, he did.
So what kind of singing did you do in church?
Well, I was sort of twisted between my father's church was Methodist, and they have sort of just flat-footed inspirational spirituals, I call it. You know, His Eyes on the Sparrow and Precious Lord and those things. That was in my father's church. Very little exaltations that were visible. I mean, people just didn't jump up and down and shout and show their joy in the Methodist church. But now, on the other hand, in the summer when I went to North Carolina, which where my mother's people were, to work and sharecrop in the fields in the summer, we went to a Baptist church, and it was totally different. You know, in the Baptist church, we didn't have the big organ and all of that like we had in the Methodist church. The music was made by patting of the foot, clapping of the hands, and everything was just done with the human voice. And, of course, it was so joyous And on the other side, if it wasn't joyous, it was so depressing. You know, there were songs like, sit down, sinner, you better sit down. Sit down, sinner, you better sit down. You ain't going to heaven, so you better sit down. If that didn't take your spirit away, nothing did, you know. And then on the other hand, you had, I got shoes and you got shoes. All God's children got shoes. When I get to heaven, I'm going to put on my shoes. Dance all over God's heaven. So in my father's church, I was christened because that was the way of the Methodist. But and my mother's and my grandmother in North Carolina, she insisted that unless you were submerged in the deep water, you hadn't done a thing. And so I stood on line at the creek and was submerged in water. So I was baptized, you know, so the Spirit had me on either side. So, you know.
Another exposure to music you had was when you were in North Carolina for the summers working in the cotton fields. A lot of people sang and shouted there. Sing me some of the things you heard in the cotton fields.
Oh, my goodness. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, and oh, Lord, have mercy on me. Oh, Lord, have mercy on me. Oh, Lord, have mercy. Have mercy on me. When the world's on fire, when the world's on fire, when the world's on fire, Lord, have mercy, mercy on me. And then there was like, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Did you sing yourself when you were working in the field?
Oh, occasionally. But I think that by that time I had started to listen on the radios back in Virginia and hear some things that I wanted to really get into musically. Of course, I was exposed, first of all, to country and western before anything else, you know. And then after country and western, the war years, I listened to, like, the Andrews Sisters and Bing Crosby and Vaughn Monroe.
This is on the radio.
Oh, this is radio. Oh, yeah. Well, radio's always been the intermediary, you know. And one thing about radio was that it very possibly was one of the reasons that rhythm and blues, as I knew it, eventually turned into rock and roll. There had to be a change because what the kids were hearing, they had the privilege of turning that dial, listening to whatever they wanted to listen to without seeing the color of your skin or who you were or what you looked like. And they were dancing to the music. And so, just like in a lot of other things, this had to make some changes because now was going to be something that was exposed. People were dancing, even though they had ropes down the center of the barnyards and all. When I played the dances, the ropes fell down lots of times, and the white kids and black kids danced together. Nobody said a thing about it until some big official, a sheriff or something, would come up and say, stop the music and put the ropes back in place. So the music itself had already started to become the common denominator, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I've seen long before Dr. King and everybody started their marches and protests, which eventually we knew would happen. But I've seen the music be so effective long time before that.
My guest is Ruth Brown. Her latest CD is called R Plus B Equals Ruth Brown. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown. Ruth Brown, you started your singing career singing at USO clubs.
Yes.
Was this during World War II or after?
Yes, this was. Well, it was between 1941 and 1945, you know, which was Pearl Harbor, was December 7, 1941. And these were the war years.
Well, you were a teenager. You were.
I was.
You were
indeed.
In your early teens during part
indeed
of this.
Indeed, I was.
So, what was it like for you as a young teenager to be singing for soldiers?
Well, to tell you the truth, I sort of snuck in to sing with the soldiers. My dad didn't know it in the beginning, because I had gotten a job working at the USO, working behind the soda fountain. And so I was allowed to go into the USO because I had a part-time job in there, so everybody thought. But my basic reasons was to get in and work and sing with that little USO show that was rehearsing there quite often. And a number of times, and I was supposed to have been in choir practice on Thursdays, I was up with the USO show. You know.
So what'd your father do when he found out?
Singing. And my dad walked in one night. Oh, sure. Somebody told him. And he walked in one night unannounced. And I was up on stage. I'll never forget. I was singing Chattanooga Choo Choo. And I tell you, my dad was that person, you know. He just didn't have to say a word. He had a look about him, you know. And there was something in his stride, you know, when he walked. There was like... You talk about body language, it was body language. And all he did was walk to the edge of the stage and look straight up at me and beckon. You know, he didn't open his mouth. All he did was come to the edge of the stage, beckon, and point, like with his finger, and say, come on down, you know. And you knew what he meant, and you knew what to expect when you got down off of that stage. But I met the force. May the force be with you. The force was with me even then when I came down, because my dad didn't even wait for me to get outside the building. He decided that if I had ignored him, then he was going to make what I had done public. And he gave me my whipping right there in public, you know. Of course, that didn't stop me. I kept sneaking around trying to sing with these shows, and did quite a few of them, you know, until I was just struggling to get to be of an eligible age, you know, when you get to be that 17 or 18, which I wasn't going to wait on anyway.
You say at some point that you realized that you could make more money singing two nights a week than your father could make working a full week.
That's right.
And I'm wondering, as a girl, what impact that realization had on you?
Well, it was really important, because I was the oldest of eight children, and being a girl had nothing to do with the fact that what your position in life was as the oldest. I was the first one that had to go to work. My dad was a dock hand and a laborer, and I think I remember going many times to pick up his paycheck or his little brown envelope with the monies in it. At that time, they didn't have checks. They just rolled up what little money they would do and put them in a little brown envelope, and that was it. And I know that he made up to $35 a week, which was big money for him. But when I went out and sang and earned $35 in one night, I knew that something here was wrong. You know, something was definitely wrong. And I'm sure that had it not been for the fact that he was a young father with all these children, if the opportunity had presented itself, he very possibly could have been a great singer, because he had a wonderful baritone voice. And I'm almost sure that sometimes now, since I've become a woman, an elderly woman now, and I look back on all of that, I realize he was probably very frustrated sometimes, because he saw in me a lot of what could have very possibly mm-hmm. happened for him. You see?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ruth Brown, and she has a new CD called R&B Equals Ruth Brown. She also wrote an autobiography a short while ago called Miss Rhythm. You won one of the amateur nights at the Apollo
yes.
sessions in, I guess it was the late 1940s.
Yes.
And then must have been 1948 or 49, Atlantic Records wanted to sign you. And
yes.
they were going to bring you up north again, this time for a paid date at the Apollo.
Yes.
What happened to you when you were driving up north to play the Apollo?
Well, we were due to be at the Apollo that Thursday for a 3 o'clock in the afternoon rehearsal, which was what they did and you rehearsed downstairs in a little place under the main theater. And we left Washington, D.C. En route to New York to be there in time for that rehearsal. And I would assume it was about, I guess, 8:45 in the morning of October 29th. I remember it well, outside of Chester, Pennsylvania. I'm still not sure what happened. Maybe the gentleman driving might have gone to sleep at the wheel. I don't know. All I know is that I remember a screeching of tires, and I remember a crash, you know, and I remember then finally hearing somebody say, the girl in the back is dead, and that they were talking about me, and they took everybody else out before they did me. And finally, when they came to move me, when they went to straighten my leg, my left leg had been broken 3 or 4 places and was back up under my body. They tried to straighten me out to pick me up, and that's when I screamed, and they realized that I was indeed not dead, just in a state of shock.
You were unable to talk until then?
Yes, I couldn't speak. I couldn't speak, whatever the reasons, and my vision, because the suitcase had fallen and hit me in the face and in the head. But I did end up in Chester Hospital and was there for 11 months and something. And once I was released after that period, in fact, my contract with Atlantic was signed while I was a patient in the hospital. They came over for my 20th birthday and brought the contracts, and I signed them on my bed in the hospital there at Chester. And when I finally did get out of the hospital, they brought me to Philadelphia, and I stayed up in North Philadelphia on Butler Street with Cab Calloway's sister, Blanche Calloway, for many, many months until I was able to manipulate around on some crutches, and then I started singing around Philadelphia and all the little clubs, you know.
So were you singing on crutches back then?
Yes, yes, I was. I was singing on crutches. They would get me to the edge of the stage and help me get up there, and more, and then I'd have a stool or something, you know. And I had braces on my left leg. I had steel braces that went down the sides of my legs and went into some shoes, you know, those real thick soles and a big heel like an orthopedic shoe. But that's the way I started back.
Did you wear big dresses to cover up the crutches?
Yes, yes, yes. That, and it became my trademark, so to speak, because in that time, crinoline petticoats.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They, you know, and the swag skirts and the saddle ox, which they were the norm. And so it did help me sort of cover up what the reality was where my legs were concerned. I started singing right around Philadelphia.
Ruth Brown, her recent autobiography is called Miss Rhythm. Her latest CD is called R plus B equals Ruth Brown. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Why you let Louise call over here and upset you like that? What are you crying about? Now, you've been married to John for 35 years. You ain't never had no problem. And all of a sudden, now you got to remember that your dear friend ain't got no husband of her own, and she gonna tell you things that make you cry. You better pay attention. Don't listen.
Coming up, more Rhythm and Blues with Ruth Brown. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan has some suggestions for those of you still searching for interesting holiday gifts. ¶¶ This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown. Her latest CD is called R plus B equals Ruth Brown. Her friend and champion, Bonnie Raitt, is featured on one track. When we left off, Ruth Brown was telling us about her early career. She signed her first record contract with the Atlantic label while she was in the hospital, recovering from a car accident that left her with two broken legs. I guess this brings us to your first record, made in 1949.
Yes.
For Atlantic Records. It was called So Long.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell us about your memories of this first recording.
I remember going in the studio on crutches to do this tune. And in fact, it was not my record session at all. Atlantic was at that time recording a section of music with Eddie Condon. It was Eddie Condon, Sid Catlett, Bobby Hackett, Joe Bushkin, Ernie Caceres, you name them. The great musicians were there, and they were doing something called Cavalcade of Music. And I don't know if it was Herb or Ahmet who had the bright idea. Yes, the bright idea to include me on one of the tracks in there just to sort of get me, you know, they found this opportunity that they could put me on this album with Eddie Condon, which they did. But not thinking that the single that they had me on was going to take off the way it did. And that was the very first tune that I'd recorded, a tune called So Long, that I'd heard a young singer years back when I was still in Virginia called Little Miss Cornshucks. She had done this tune, and I used to hear it by her. Her real name was Mildred Cunningham, one of the most interesting little artists I've ever seen. She used to sit on the side of the stage with her legs hanging over, with a straw hat and bare feet and a straw basket. And they would put one little light on her, and she'd sit there and sing this song, So Long. And people would walk up and put money in that basket. I've never seen anything like her since that time, with the exception of maybe Judy Garland, who sat on the side of the stage and sang Over the Rainbow. But I saw Little Miss Cornshuck sit on the side of the stage long before I saw that, you know. But that's where I got the song.
Well, Ruth Brown, let's listen to your version, your first recording, 1949, of So Long.
So long, hope we'll meet again someday. Oh, that maybe then you'll say, darling, I was wrong. So long, gee, I hate to see you go. You're the world to me, you know. You've been mine so long.
That's Ruth Brown, her first recording made in 1949. Ruth Brown, this recording made the rhythm and blues charts.
Mm-hmm.
But your next few records didn't do as well.
Mm-hmm.
Was it hard for you to find the right material?
Yes, it was in a way, but as I said, I didn't have that much to do about it. And I think that one of the things that made the difference was that when I went with Atlantic Records, I was the first female on that label. And I consequently had an opportunity to hear all of the good material when it came. And they had a lot of wonderful staff writers over there, you know, like Rudy Toombs and Tony Orlando and Bobby Darin and Neil Sedaka and Otis Blackwell and Lieber and Stroller, all these young men who were writers and bringing material. But as long as I was with Atlantic in those early years, and they had not become as big a label, but when they started to fill out with other performers and their roster got so big, I wasn't the one to see the good material all the time. You know, there were a lot of ways for it to be spread around.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that somewhere that's where I felt as though we sort of lost track of each other because I didn't get some of the good material again. And then once again, the record company had become so big and were continuously becoming bigger. They had people now like Ray Charles and the Clovers and the Drifters, and they had, who else, Roberta Flack and Aretha Franklin and you name it, you know, the Laverne Baker was there by that time. So Ruth Brown wasn't the one that always got the good material.
When you became a rhythm and blues star, you toured with some of the rhythm and blues and rock and roll shows. And I'm wondering if you could give us a taste of what it was like for you as a performer to be in those rock and roll shows.
Oh, it was wonderful. But of course, they came along a little later, I think. They started, there was a father and son team out of West Virginia who booked all those shows called the Super Shows. The Weinbergs were the promoters, and they put these shows together. They had this brilliant idea. And at one time, there were people on the bus like the Clovers, the Drifters, the Five Keys, Lester Young, Buddy Johnson's orchestra, Ella Johnson, and then you would have like a Sam Cooke, you know, and you would have a John Coltrane, and you would have Paul Huckabuck Williams and Charles Brown and Roy Brown, and sometimes there were about 10 acts on one bill, and the ticket only cost about $7.50, you know.
So you're saying,
but it was wonderful.
Did Lester Young share the bill with the Drifters and the Clovers?
Oh, of course, with me.
Uh-huh.
Of course.
Must have been an awfully interesting bus ride.
It was interesting, but we were so young and naive, I didn't realize the greatness of a lot of these people I was working with. I even worked with Joe Louis, the heavyweight champion of the world. A lot of people don't know that, but he went on the road and toured with me and did comedy. you know.
What kind of comedy? Did you?
He did just what it is he does. He played the boxer, and he had a little guy with him named Leonard Reed who played his second. He was the one that he was always trying to punch out, you know. And Joe came out with us when he lost his heavyweight title to Ezra Charles. He came on the road and rode the bus with us.
Huh.
Joe Louis, Billy Eckstine, the Count Basie Orchestra, Nipsey Russell, my dear friend, Red Fox. You talk about shows. You will never see anything like that again.
During part of the time when you were touring, you were also pregnant.
Yes.
What was it like to, before pregnancy was as socially accepted in working women as it is today?
A lot of people didn't know it.
Or in show business. So you just covered it up?
They didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just put on those full skirts and full dresses and went on out there, you know. Well, the first time that I gave birth to my first child, I was working with Charles Brown at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't aware that I was pregnant. I was told that I had tumors. And we got to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and I got so sick, I went to the doctor, and he x-rayed me, and he said, come, I want you to take a look at this tumor you've got here. It's not a tumor, it's a baby, you know? And it was then that I decided I was going to come in off the road, and Dinah Washington came out and took my place.
My guest is Ruth Brown. Her latest CD is called R Plus B Equals Ruth Brown. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown. I would like you, Ruth Brown, to choose if you have one your favorite of your early recordings, and we'll play that.
Oh, there are so many that were good, but I think if I had to choose one, it would probably be at this point in my life, Oh, What a Dream.
And why are you choosing that one?
Because this whole life has been a dream, I tell you. When I look back at it, and I have been recently editing the manuscript because my book was purchased and it's going to be a film.
Oh.
And I've been editing manuscript, and I can't believe some of the things that did happen. And when I look back on it now, it's, I don't know, it seems like a dream. That's what it is, you know?
Well, let's hear your 1954 recording, Oh, What a Dream.
Woke up this morning and I looked around, so disappointed I laid back down. Oh, what a dream, what a dream I had last night. Dreamed I held you in my arms, but I'm still waiting for that day to come. Oh, what a dream, what a dream I had last night. Dream we were walking down the aisle. The organ was playing, here comes the bride. You looked down at me, you began to smile. When I looked around, everybody began to cry. How
That's Ruth Brown, recorded in 1954. Ruth Brown, you've said that you always knew how to choose a good song, but you weren't as good at picking a good man.
You read the Rock and Roll magazine, didn't you? A Rolling Stone, yes.
I think one of your husbands didn't want you to work, and so you basically retired from music for a while. What was that like for you to not sing professionally?
Very hard. Very hard. I sang a little, but as I said, I was living in an environment. My husband that you're speaking about was a police officer, and he became a role model for my sons. That's what I really wanted, a real strong male image for the both of them. And The breakup of that marriage was totally my doing. It was totally my doing because I got the yearn to get back to the stage. I missed all of that, and I tried being your suburban housewife, you know, and going to the bowling leagues with the kids and doing all the things that a suburban wife does. It did not work out, and we separated but became friends, stayed friends until the day he died, which was just last year. We were still in communication with each other. So,
was there ever a point during your adult life when you couldn't earn a living singing and you had to do other jobs?
Oh, yes, of course.
What did you do?
Of course. I did domestic work. I drove a school bus.
You did domestic work after you had rhythm and blues hits?
Oh, sure. This was during the 60s. That wasn't too long ago. This was during the 60s, the advent of the Beatles and the British invasion. And the business became a little more complicated. But that wasn't really the reason I left, because I really chose. Somewhere down the line, it started to sort of ease back because I had two wonderful children and I wanted to spend more time where they were. And it went back a few years before that I thought of it, because my mother used to take care of my sons, and I remember coming home one time to visit. My only tie to my children had been material things, you know, things that you could send money home for and purchase gifts. And I came home, and my oldest, of course, was jovial and jumping up, but my baby, who my mother had chosen for her own. The only thing she didn't do was give him birth. That's why she loved him so much. When I went to reach for my baby, he didn't want me to touch him, and he screamed and yelled, you know, and I think that was probably the first day that I said to myself, well, I got to do something about this, and that was one of the reasons that I finally decided to come in, so to speak. But in those times, I did many things. I did domestic work. I cooked. I worked in daycare. I worked in the home for retarded children. I worked in drug abuse as a counselor. I drove a school bus. I worked in Head Start. I worked wherever I could bring a paycheck home. You know.
Well, how did you feel after the adulation that you'd get on stage cleaning other people's houses?
Well, I didn't feel anything about it because what I was doing was earn a living, a clean, decent living. And it was what my mother had done all of her life, so I felt no shame about it because I did that with as much dignity as I do anything else. I did a good job. I was a good housekeeper, you know. And it wasn't until my needs were of such that I was cleaning house one day and I heard my music. I heard a disc jockey talking about my greatness and how great Ruth Brown was. And at that time, I think I was scrubbing a floor. And that is when I sort of made up my mind that there was some money that belonged to me that I had not been receiving. You know, I had not gotten a royalty statement in almost 30 years. I hadn't seen one. You know, and my records were being sold all over the country, and he was talking about how big this was in Japan and in Germany, and I had no idea about this. So I began this battle, this uphill battle it was, to maintain and reclaim something that was really mine. I refused to beg because I was going to fight for I knew what was mine. You know, if these records are being sold, then I'm entitled to my part of whatever they're being sold for.
You sued your first record company. What was the outcome of
the suit? My first and only one. I sued them. I fought them for 11 years. I fought 11 years for royalty reform. I fought with a young lawyer out of Washington, a young man who walked up to me one day with some Ruth Brown records under his arm, and I asked him where he got them, and he told me how he paid for them. We struck up a conversation. He became my best friend and worked. We fought almost 11 years to get record reform, which we did. And I finally, now after all these years, I'm getting record royalties back again for the first time in many, many years, you know.
You made a comeback in the 80s with a series of music theater reviews, including Black and Blue. And I'm wondering now how, when you're performing on stage, the feeling and the audience compare with the earlier part of your career in the 50s.
I cannot explain to you what it's like now. It's, I would suppose that it's like what people try to explain if they say they're on a high. You know, if you ever walk out on the stage and you stand there, and you work an hour, hour and 20 minutes, sometimes more than that. And when you finish what it is you've done, people push their chairs back and stand to their feet and applaud you. It's kind of awesome. But the beautiful thing is that there are a lot of young faces out there that are now becoming aware of this music that I was a part of. And a lot of them, not because they knew my music, but I did another crazy thing one day. I did a film called Hairspray. And I gained a whole following of new young people with that crazy movie.
It's a great movie. It's a John Waters movie.
Yes, ma'am, with Ricky Lake.
Yeah, with Ricky Lake. It was her first big role.
Yes.
And it's about one of those dance shows in Baltimore.
It was
kind of like
an
American Bandstand, but one set in Baltimore.
It was a real show. Yeah. I remember the reality of it. And it was in a time when John Waters was a young man. He grew up hearing that. And I remember those situations very, very well.
Uh-huh.
And I had said, well, I'm not going to do this film, especially when they took me to wardrobe and brought that white wig out. I said, not on your life, you know. But, of course, it was I can't call his name. He died.
Divine.
I call him the Divine. He came to me and said, girl, put that wig on your head and make some money. And I said to him, no, I'm going to lose every fan I've got in the world if I come out with this white wig. And Divine said, well, I tell you what, for every one you lose, I'm going to bring you two. And every time I see that film, and it runs continuously, and I've gone into grocery stores and see young people following me around, my ego says, oh, they know who I am, Ruth Brown, that kind of thing. And then they will eventually say, aren't you Motormouth Maybelle?
That was your role in the movie.
That was my role and continues to be my claim to fame. You know, that cult film has really been wonderful. I go to the mailbox quite often now and find a little check with John Waters, God bless him, on it. He writes to me and sends me crazy Christmas cards and things until this day.
Well, Ruth Brown, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. I've done all the talking, you see. I always warn people, you know, I say, whenever I get a chance to be interviewed, don't ever say, tell me something about yourself, because, honey, I got about 60 years here to talk about. But you've been very kind.
And I've enjoyed hearing your story. And
thank
you very, very much. Ruth Brown's recent autobiography is called Miss Rhythm. Her latest CD is called R plus B equals Ruth Brown. This is Fresh Air. Serious, frenzied, last-minute shopping begins today. For this year's book shopping list, critic Maureen Corrigan recommends that we look beyond the bookstore shelves featuring the glitzy new releases and instead consider some literary hits of holiday seasons past.
There's a section of my local video store labeled Staff Recommendations, whose shelves are dotted with little signs that say things like, if you enjoyed Demi Moore in Striptease, try Gypsy, starring Natalie Wood. These staff picks have sometimes guided me to older films that I'd never heard of or just never bothered to see. And so, for this holiday season's gift book list, I'm following the lead of those video store elves. I'm taking advantage of the popularity of some current bestsellers to recommend a few literary chestnuts and beloved personal favorites whose characters, language, and images, like visions of sugar plums, are perennially dancing in my head. 1997 was the year of doorstop-sized historical novels by big-name authors. If Don DeLillo's Underworld appealed to you, why not try Ralph Ellison's surrealistic classic, Invisible Man? Invisible Man was published in 1952, the year after DeLillo's novel Opens, and like Underworld, it surveys decades of American life with a biting humor and a justifiable paranoia. Thomas Pynchon's mammoth book, Mason and Dixon, returned us to the bawdy, barely charted America of the 18th century, and did so by mimicking 18th century language. But why restrict yourself to imitation Enlightenment fiction when you can also experience the real thing? Lawrence Stern's 1759 novel, The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, is a topsy-turvy comic treasure whose experiments with the novel form paved the way for later innovative efforts by the likes of James Joyce and, of course, Pynchon himself. Philip Roth's slimmer but substantive historical novel, American Pastoral, traces the changes wrought upon one Newark, New Jersey family by the turbulence of the 1960s. If you're looking for another novel that devastatingly contrasts the 1950s and 60s, you must read E.L. Doctorow's 1971 masterpiece, The Book of Daniel, a fictional recounting of the Rosenberg case and its terrible legacy. Because the Book of Daniel is one of my favorite novels of all time, I often teach it. One of my students once turned in a paper that serenely declared, "The Rosenbergs were put to death by electrolysis." It's a testament to the Book of Daniel that even that howler couldn't detract from the novel's enduring power. Finally, Charles Frazier's Civil War novel, Cold Mountain, was the stealth historical fiction hit of the year. I loved it, just as I also loved David Bradley's 1981 novel, The Cheneysville Incident, which reconstructs the ordeal of a band of escaped slaves. The Cheneysville Incident is temporarily out of print, but it's worth hunting for in used bookstores. For adolescent readers interested in the Civil War era, a recent discovery of mine is Anne Rinaldi's book, An Acquaintance with Darkness, an atmospheric story about the days surrounding the Lincoln assassination, told through the perspective of a plucky 14-year-old girl. Enough with historical fiction, on to true-life terror. 1997 was also a big year for extreme adventure tales like John Krakauer's Into Thin Air and Sebastian Younger's The Perfect Storm. If you like this kind of literature, I urge you to read Norman MacLean's 1992 book, Young Men and Fire, about the group of Forest Service smoke jumpers who battled Montana's deadly Man Gulch fire in 1949. Its tough lyricism and haunting meditations on courage and death infuse MacLean's account with the greatness of classical elegy. Children, too, need to be inspired by real-life feats of heroism. For beginning readers, I highly recommend Trapped by the Ice, a vividly illustrated new book by Michael McCurdy that tells the story of the 1914 Shackleton expedition to the South Pole and the crew's harrowing 2-year struggle to reach inhabited land after their ship was crushed by ice. Another kind of nonfiction genre, autobiography, continued to flourish in 1997, with Frank McCourt's Angela's Ashes deservedly still dominating the bestseller lists. Happily, this was also the year that Vivian Gornick's superb 1987 memoir, Fierce Attachments, came back into print. Gornick does for the Bronx and Jewish mother-daughter bonds what McCourt does for Limerick and the ties between Irish mothers and their sons. Finally, 1997 was also graced with a superabundance of fine literary biographies. Hermione Lee's Life of Virginia Woolf, Claire Tomalin's biography of Jane Austen, and the first volume of R.F. Foster's biography of W.B. Yeats. Why not wait for the paperbacks of these acclaimed books and, as a present to yourself, curl up with Edgar Johnson's definitive and still dazzling 1952 biography of Charles Dickens? What better way to spend the holidays than to settle into a cushy chair and read about the hectic life of the literary genius who invented Christmas as we now know it?
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Sweet Hereafter is a new movie about how a small town deals with a school bus crash that has killed many of its children. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Adam Egoyan, the director, and Russell Banks, whose novel the film is based on. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.